Ecologic to bring you news of environmental events and people who are making a difference.
The Pacifica Foundation that owns WBAI is facing a new threat, and your vote will be needed.
Now is the time until April 7th to renew your WBAI membership, and please choose Ecologic as your favorite program.
Go to give2wbai.org or call 212-209-2950.
Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone?
He visited my house.
Hi, I'm Steve Rath. This week on Folk Radio, we'll welcome back producer and player David Mansfield with his friends and Fallout Shelter guests, Rochelle Garnier, Mary Lee Cortez, and Eric Roscoe Amble, Catherine Russell, and Amy Helm.
I loved you the minute you walked through the door, started humming a love song, hummed it sweet and slow. Your eyes called me, now I'm hypnotized.
2 hours of great new songs and singers. I hope you'll join us Thursday night from 10 to midnight or online at WBAI.org.
WBAI's local station board, the Pacifica Foundation Board, responsible for advising local management and operations, is holding a meeting on Wednesday, April 14th at 7 p.m. It's a remote access meeting accessible to the public, including an opportunity for public comment. The LSB meeting is Wednesday, April 14th at 7 p.m. The fastest and easiest way to join the meeting is by using the link on the Pacifica calendar and on the WBAI website. You can also access the meeting by calling 929-205-6099 and enter this meeting ID 922-457-2995, 922-457-2995. And if that wasn't enough numbers, we also have a password. The password is 995, like WBAI's frequency, 995. So it's 995-995-99. Again, the phone number to call is 929-205-6099. The meeting ID is 922-457-2995. And the password is easy to remember because it's 995-995-99. Instructions for signing on to the meeting, including a link for listening over the web, is available through WBAI's main webpage, WBAI.org. Thanks for listening to all these numbers, and we hope you join us at the LSB meeting, April 14th at 7 p.m.
Okay, ready or not, I think it's time for RPM, Revolutions Per Minute. You're tuned to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. What am I hearing? All right, they're talking in my ear and I can't concentrate. All right, well, WBAI New York, home of the hits.
Revolutions Per Minute is a weekly radio show from the New York City chapter of the Democratic Socialists of America. recorded live at WBAI 99.5 in Brooklyn every Wednesday at 9 p.m. RPM's about doing the work to build a democratic socialist future. Each week, hear the latest news, analysis, and organizing experience from the minds and hearts of activists fighting every day in New York City. Join the movement at socialists.nyc.
Hey, New York City, this is Lee Zishi coming to you from Bed-Stuy, Brooklyn and occupied Lenape land. You're listening to Revolutions Per Minute live on WBAI, a socialist radio show and podcast from members of New York City Democratic Socialist of America. The Democratic Socialist of America is the largest socialist organization in the United States with 90,000 members nationwide, and New York City DSA is its biggest chapter. We are run by our over 7,000 plus members and organizers who are working together to build democratic socialism in all five boroughs. After hours of late night negotiations by legislators and months of organizing by advocates, New York State has a budget. Now that the budget is done, what is the next big fight for socialists in Albany? We have Assemblymember Emily Gallagher on live with us tonight to talk about what the DSA slate has been able to accomplish so far and what comes next. We'll also hear from comrades from the Eco-Socialist Working Group and Tech Action Working Group about their campaigns for public power and public broadband. But first, the headlines with Simone Norman.
State finally legalized recreational marijuana use for adults after multiple failed attempts in previous years. Senate Majority Leader Andrea Stewart-Cousins, Assembly Speaker Carl Heastie, and Governor Andrew Cuomo announced a budget deal on Tuesday, which passed the state legislature at 3:30 a.m. on Wednesday and is now law. The budget will raise around $5 billion in new taxes through sports betting and increasing taxes on the rich, which is around one-tenth of the $50 billion proposed by the progressive Invest in Our New York coalition. Additionally, the state budget did not repeal the Medicaid global cap, the arbitrary spending limit Governor Cuomo imposed on Medicaid spending in 2011. More than $4 billion owed to underfunded public schools, also known as foundation aid, will finally be dispersed, starting with an initial payment of $1.4 billion this year. Neither of the two homelessness prevention programs prioritized by housing advocates were passed. A $2.1 billion fund for excluded workers ineligible for federal COVID relief funds was established, which is the first of its kind in the country. DSA endorsed Assemblymember Marcella Mitaines of Sunset Park joined a hunger strike to demand that the fund contain $3.5 billion. The enacted budget had no designated funding to meet New York State's emissions targets, which were part of the previously enacted Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act. And finally, corporate immunity for nursing homes was repealed in the budget, and a broad range of health care cuts proposed by Governor Cuomo were defeated. The New York Health Act, which would bring single-payer health care to the state, is now sponsored by a majority in both the Senate and Assembly for the first time. New York health officials were allegedly told to prioritize friends and allies of Governor Cuomo in the earlier days of the pandemic. Finally, Republican Assembly Minority Leader Robert Ort submitted an ethics complaint to the state's Joint Commission on Public Ethics, charging Governor Cuomo with leveraging state resources to cover up negative details of his COVID response in order to receive a $4 million book deal. And in election news, Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez endorsed Brad Lander for NYC Comptroller. City Council member Costa Constantinidis of Astoria abruptly resigned 8 months before he was scheduled to vacate his term-limited seat. Given the timing of his resignation, less than 90 days from the June 22nd primary, it will not trigger a special election. That means Astoria will not have an elected representative in City Council during upcoming budget negotiations. And finally, DSA endorsed City Council candidate Michael Hollingsworth of District 35 in Crown Heights was endorsed by LIUNA New York, a major building trades union.
Our headlines are brought to you by The Thorn, an incredible weekly newsletter by New York City DSA Electoral Working Group covering local politics and radical activism. Subscribe at thethorn.nyc. And for our extended headline tonight, here's RPM's Jack Devine on the organizing going on right now to save Chinatown's only unionized restaurant.
All right. Well, we're going to guess at which clip it is. Stand by. We're switching back and forth between computers.
Yo, what's good, everybody? This is Jack Devine, and I'm here with Zishan Ning, who is part of the fight in Chinatown to protect the unionized workers and preserve the a great restaurant, Jin Fong. So I just want to thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So can you just break down for our listeners, why is Jin Fong under threat? Who is involved in the struggle to preserve the restaurant and protect these unionized jobs? How does it connect to maybe broader fights in Chinatown and the Lower East Side? And how can our listeners get involved in this struggle?
Sure. So I'm part of the coalition to protect Chinatown and the Lower East Side. We have been fighting against displacement and for the protection of the Chinatown and the Lower East Side against luxury high rises and real estate speculations for years. And Jin Fong Restaurant is one big example of that, because it's located in the heart of Chinatown, and for many years it has served the community. And many people, Chinese, non-Chinese, all recognize that Jin Fong Restaurant is an iconic location. So if Jin Fong gone, then many people would feel that Chinatown is pretty much gone, because it has a big dining room and people, you know, gather there and they you know, sharing their moments and have, it also hosts a lot of big events there. Like you mentioned earlier, it's also a unionized restaurant. It's the only unionized restaurant in Chinatown. And also it has a history of labor struggle that end up, you know, with the unionization and prove for many years that the labor and management actually can work together to benefit the community. But because of the displacement, right, the lot of rents and the real estate tax increase because of all the real estate speculation coming into our neighborhood, the landlord, the Chu family, who owns a lot of property in Chinatown. They are also the biggest landlord in Chinatown. They have been using that real estate tax increase to put the pressure, you know, on the restaurant. They also have a profit share of the restaurant business. But during the pandemic, they see this opportunity to kick them out and to maybe think of using this space for some other use. They also have a history of doing that. One example is the hotel right next door, which also used to be a restaurant, and now it's become like a tall, fancy hotel, right? And that's because our neighborhood has no protection from the city government to stop the displacement. So in this context, right, when Jin Fong facing this forced closure from the landlord, the workers, of course, they immediately recognize, right? One is, of course, they're going to lose their job. But two, also this kind of losing the job is also part of the displacement pressure, the result, you know, of being displaced. So when we talk about displacement, sometimes we talk about focus on the, like the tenant eviction, right? But it's, of course, more than that. It's also small business shut down and also workers losing their jobs. And we have seen this like before and during the pandemic, a lot of small business shut down because of the rising rents. But this time is different because workers, because they have been organizing and now they're actually taking the lead, you know, to say, you know, we refuse to let this go, you know, go on. And they want to keep their job, but also saving the larger community. And they have also been involved in the anti-displacement fights for many years. So now they are coming up to hold the landlord Chu family accountable. And especially now, you know, in the midst of this racial violence and stuff going on, it's really shameful for the Chu family, you know, actually selling out our community, selling out Chinatown and the Lower East Side. Plus, they also actually, the Jonathan Chu, the son in the Chu family, he's also the board co-chair of Museum of Chinese in America, which actually accept Mayor de Blasio's bribe to support the new jail to be put in Chinatown. It's $35 million. So now we have been going through like two big protests, and Jonathan and Alex Chu, the father in the Chu family, they have been totally ignored the community's demands to keep the Jin Fong dining room open. And now they have been shutting it down. So the workers and the supporters and all of us, we are doing a picket line in front of all his businesses, including his bank. He's also the True Family is also the owner of East Bank, and also the museum we mentioned earlier, and also the hotel. We're going to maintain a picket line twice a week in front of their business to boycott their business until they meet the community's demands. One is to reopen the Jin Fong dining room, and B is to return the $35 million to actually help the recovery of our community to protect the workers and the small businesses. So if anyone interested to learn more and want to get involved in our action, it happens every week. You can send an email to peoplefirstnyc@gmail.com. That's peoplefirstnyc@gmail.com.
Well, I just want to thank you so much for joining us on Revolution Per Minute and sharing the information about this really crucial struggle in Chinatown. And we want to express our solidarity with everyone involved. Revolutions Per Minute hopes to keep our listeners updated on the fight, and we'd love to have you back on for a kind of a more deep dive into the struggles in Chinatown. But just thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you. And I look forward to that.
You're listening to Revolutions Per Minute live on WBAI 99.5. Tonight, we are joined by Assembly Member Emily Gallagher. Emily, thanks so much for being on RPM after a very long week already on Wednesday in Albany.
Thanks, Lee. I'm really excited to be here with one of my favorite activists in my community. So I'm really honored to be here.
We're so, so happy to have you. And we're going to dig in a little bit more into what's been happening in Albany and what you, as part of the Socialist Slate, will be fighting for. But first, we would just love to get our audience just to get to know you a little bit better. Can you just talk a little bit about your own organizing history and how that led to DSA?
Sure. Yeah. So I've been an activist really since my high school days, but in this community, in the 50th district, I started organizing and being engaged in 2006. And that was really, coming out of the work that I had been doing as an artist, assistant. I was working for environmental justice artists, and I was learning quite a bit about what was going on in my own community in regards to Superfund sites. And I had a very strong principle, really coming out of like punk and coming out of just my own reading of leftist literature growing up, that it was really important for me to not just talk about things and look at things from a privileged perspective, but actually get involved at the ground level. So I started getting involved. I joined a local activist group called NAG, Neighbors. It started Neighbors Against Garbage, then it became Neighbors Allied for Good Growth. And it's gone through several transitions since. But one of the core fights there was to clean up the garbage, the illegal garbage dumps that were on the waterfront. And then we transitioned to fighting for the promises that were made to this community in the 2005 rezoning that were never fulfilled. So I really gained a lot of insight into the interdisciplinary aspect of all the different pieces of organizing that we do, how environmental justice influences social justice, how housing and work and transportation and all of these things are really tangled together as one struggle. So I really started to learn about that. I started to get to know the history of activism in my community, which is very long and very storied. And there's been a lot of heroic working class activism in District 50, which is Greenpoint, Williamsburg, and a slice of Clinton Hill. So I got more and more involved. I became also deeply aware of the role of socialism in organizing through the work that I was doing as a New York City museum educator. And I became more and more hungry to see these two things brought together in my own life, the activism that I was doing after work and the stories that I was telling about activists in the past and the push towards actually deep political change and change at the government level that would allow more working class voices to control the narrative and to control the story of what was going on rather than it being separate. So, you know, during this time, I was, you know, going to Occupy Wall Street, and I was in awe of what was being built there. And I started to also see some political organizing happening on the left here in my district, really all the way back in 2008 with the formation of another club, New Kings Democrats, that said that essentially the Brooklyn Democratic machine was not including the voices of the community. It was really kind of an organization that was favoring their own family members and people who really represented a very narrow viewpoint rather than the robust diversity of Brooklyn. And they started fighting for involvement of people who cared in all of the institutions of the political spectrum. So with that, I got involved with them, and I kept struggling a little bit because I found that I was often further left than many of the people that I was working with. But, you know, of course, I also knew many, many other leftists and socialists that I was working with. But I was very excited when I started to see a stronger left flank emerging. And I was really curious because I had already been involved in some campaigns to fight some of the machine all the way back in like 2012, 2013. And we had floundered. We really didn't have this ground game. We didn't have this strength to really push through. And we were actually in that time challenging Martin Dillon. And I was very excited in 2016 when DSA brought a candidate who was a housing organizer that I knew from the district, Debbie Medina, to run for that state Senate seat. And she did not win, but I was very inspired that, you know, this was starting to build and grow in the district, a true left voice, and that organizing capacity was really starting out. So I was very excited the next cycle in 2018, when Julia Salazar won that seat. And then I started to feel that, you know, the impact that I saw happening at the state level just from this one cycle of freshmen who were wiping out the IDC, who were caucusing with Republicans, fake Democrats. I started to think how incredible it would be if we had a similar flank in the assembly. So I decided that I would run for the seat of my assembly member, who at that time had been already in office in 2020 for 48 years. And I just felt like, you know, the community had changed so drastically. And I'd been on the ground fighting against so many of the redevelopments, so many of the problems, fighting for more open space, fighting for environmental justice in this community. And I just thought that I could trust that I would be able to bring all those voices with me to Albany and build a co-governance style. And I also knew that the way that the machine really worked was that they would usually wait for someone to either retire or die in office, because then the hyper-local community Democrats, the county committee and the district leaders would get to choose who would succeed that person. So I wanted to make sure that did not happen in my district and that we actually had the opportunity to have a real election, because usually when that succession happens, there's almost never a real opportunity. People don't like to run against incumbents. So I ran, I was elected. And then in January, because I've been running a truly socialist office and a socialist campaign, I was invited to join in to the DSA slate. So that brings us up to today.
Yes. And so now you're in Albany as an assemblywoman, and the New York State budget just passed. And I know there's a whole lot there, but I kind of want to, if you could just kind of briefly talk about it, because I also want to make sure we have plenty of time to talk
about
it.
Yeah, sure.
But if you could just talk about what socialists want in the budget, and, you know, maybe what were some of the biggest barriers to getting what we fully wanted?
Right. So I think the biggest struggle for us was focusing on a just recovery. And what that meant to us was making sure that all of the working people were getting bailed out the way that we always bail out the wealthy, the way we always bail out the banks and the mega corporations, that we were going to be able to bail out tenants. We were going to be able to bail out every level of worker, whether or not they were working in, you know, the old school economy of 9 to 5, or if they were a street vendor or what have you. And we also really wanted to make sure that we were building something for the future, because so often when we're in a crisis, we just take a mega dose of federal money and we don't think ahead about how do we develop a robust economy for the future that we can always fund these things. We're not scrambling every time. You know, it's just like kind of my own bank account. I'm still learning how to like be a saver and like have all the different funds that I'm going to need to have the life that I want to live. Right. I tend to be, I feel like our states are like this too. We get a paycheck and we spend it all at once. Right. So how do we have a sustainable income for the state? And, you know, what we really learned and know, and especially the DSA debtors and the debt and finance collective, was that the way that we've been taxing people is just really focused on the backs of working people. We've taxed income, but we don't tax wealth. And wealth is what is passed down through generations, what is mostly hoarded by, you know, white privileged people. And that money that sits in accounts or stocks or in artwork or all kinds of different kinds of investments, it doesn't ever go into the system to help other people. So it's really just like they call it like a nest egg, something you're sitting on. So we really wanted to think about how could we shift the economy. So the biggest challenge was definitely in, I think we had a fairly easy time finding the progressives who have been hungering for this kind of work and for this kind of alliance. There's been a lot of people there who haven't been able to do the progressive things that they've wanted to do because they just didn't have the numbers of the votes. So we were able to find and build with those people very quickly. But, you know, the state has very different regions. And there's also, like I was saying, with the Brooklyn Democratic machine and its history, that's the history of Democratic machines across our state. So there's a lot of folks who are in office who might be coming out of that kind of process where you're more rewarded for being loyal than for being innovative and for being courageous, right? And there's a lot of fear about, you know, taking a stance for something that might weaken the kind of longevity and the look of a truly collective democratic front, right? So a lot of people, you know, we found ourselves just having a great deal of struggle just with the introduction of these kind of radical shifts, made a lot of our peers uncomfortable. And I think it's going to be something that we continue to have to build and to struggle with. And I think that this is the first time of a new This is the first budget of a new era of New York state politics. And it's going to be interesting to see who jumps in and who falls out.
Yeah, and it'll definitely be interesting to see, you know, what happens now that the budget is done, since that takes up so much space in Albany in the first couple months. And I know you're a supporter of public power. Can you talk a little bit about the energy issues in your district and why you support these bills? And we'll be hearing a little bit more about them later in the show.
Sure, great. Yeah, so I'm in Greenpoint, and we are a historic community in terms of the fallout of the energy industry, right? We had Exxon Oil here for like over 100 years, and we have the pollution to prove it. And what is happening right now is that there, and you know very well about this, there is a pipeline being built across Brooklyn to store LNG gas, and it's going into an LNG plant, liquefied natural gas, that would be in my district. And public power is going to be really important to moving away from projects like this. My goal is to help the community stop this this pipeline and stop this LNG plant. But it's important to think about how this represents the wrong path that we're on, because LNG is one of the kind of fake green fuels that people are trying to turn to instead of renewables. It's like a way that we're trying to basically continue our reliance on gas and on fossil fuels. So we really need to have public power, because we need to be able to shift who's in control of the grid, as well as shifting what kind of resources that we're going to do. And the first step in that is going to be very important, which is actually allowing New York to own its own renewables. Because right now, the New York Power Authority is not really allowed to build or own their own renewable energy. And that is preventing us from having any source in RG&E or wherever it is that you are in the state who is distributing the fuel. So basically, we need to have public power, because then we can change the conversation about what power is about. One of the reasons why they want to build this pipeline is they want to increase the rates, and they can do that more easily when they have a project that they can say they spent money on. And those are all happening behind closed doors in you know, very difficult to get into meetings about, you know, the power generation and the distribution. So if we can shift away from that model, we won't see our state investing in short-term thinking, investing in equipment and in processes that really move us away from our goals with the climate leadership and the CLCPI, which, you know, the UN climate targets as well. We're not meeting them. We're not moving towards them as long as we are building these projects and really trying to attach ourselves to ways to make profits for shareholders of Con Edison or of National Grid. That's just, we're never going to be able to fully invest and build the future that we need to have in terms of energy efficiency, in terms of the cost and it being really available to people, and in terms of just really having control over it. Because right now we don't have control over our energy, and we are absolutely reliant on it.
And yeah, Emily, there's so much more I want to talk to you about. But in order to get to our interviews with our other comrades, we might have to save this for another show. But thank you so much for being on. And we will definitely have you back on RPM soon.
I am a very verbose person, so I'm not surprised it took up a lot of time. But yeah, we'll come back soon.
Cool. Well, thank you so much,
Lee.
And thanks for all you're doing in Albany.
Thanks for all you're doing here on the ground.
You're listening to Revolutions Per Minute live on WBAI, broadcasting in New York City at 99.5 FM and streaming on your favorite podcast apps. We just heard from Assemblymember Emily Gallagher. But Public Power isn't the only DSA campaign for public utilities. RPM's Amy Wilson spoke with Kevin Way of the Tech Action Working Group about the campaign for public broadband.
Hey, New York City. This is Amy Wilson for Revolutions Per Minute. I'm here with Kevin from our Tech Action Working Group. Hi, Kevin. How are you today?
Hey, Amy. I'm doing great. Super excited to be here, and thank you so much to RPM for having us.
Oh, wonderful. We're happy to have you here. So before we dig into our topic for this interview, could you just briefly introduce yourself and tell me a little bit about why you're coming on the show today?
Sure. So my name is Kevin. I am a member of the New York City DSA Tech Action Working Group's organizing committee. For those of you who aren't familiar with us, Tech Action is a relatively new working group that was established around 2016, 2017 to advocate for technology and digital inclusion policies. And, you know, specifically, we have done work on the Amazon HQ2 fight. We're doing work on the municipal broadband campaign, which we're super excited about and are here to talk about today.
Great. Yeah. So we're here to sort of place the municipal broadband campaign in context of one of DSA's other flagship campaigns, the Public Power, that's guided by our eco-socialist working group. So it's really cool to see the parallels between these two different campaigns, one established and one now just launching out of your working group. So if you would, tell me a little bit about the broad strokes. What is this municipal broadband campaign?
So municipal broadband is sort of an idea that's been around for, you know, at least the early 2000s. There's a lot of different iterations of it, but our campaign is demanding and fighting for the establishment of a publicly owned, municipally operated, 100% unionized broadband service and infrastructure network to be built and owned and operated by New York City. So that's the short one-line explanation.
Great. And let's dig into that a little bit more. I know that this is a coalitional campaign. There's involvement and buy-in from other groups other than New York City DSA. So talk to me a little bit about that. Who is at the table with this?
Yeah, so we are very excited to actually have around 10 coalitions so far. So that includes our working group, but it also includes IBEW Local 3, which is the local representing striking charter spectrum technicians. And they have been on strike for over four years and a week now, as of late March. So they are a member of our coalition. The Moore Caucus of the United Federation of Teachers is also on board, as well as Volcker NY and a number of other progressive groups.
Great. Let's talk a little bit about the sort of connective tissue that holds these groups together. You know, on the first blush, the question of why would the Moore Caucus of UFT, who we've had members of here on Revolutions Per Minute in the past, why would radical teachers be interested in municipal broadband, right? It's maybe not evident at first glance. So let's dig into the importance of the municipal broadband campaign. What are the problems that this public utility would solve?
Yeah, so that's a really good question, and I'm really glad you asked, because there are so many problems, I think, with our current internet and broadband infrastructure in New York City. You know, probably the one thing that comes to the top of mind is sort of existing broadband monopolies and the level of service that they provide. You know, there's not a ton of options available for New Yorkers. You got Charter, Spectrum, you got Verizon Fios, maybe a couple other ones. Some people are lucky enough to have, you know, NYC Mesh or community operated networks that are sort of co-opted or neighborhood and community owned and operated. But for most of us, you know, we don't necessarily have the level of service that we would like or need to go to school online or to work online. So that's sort of one thing. You know, a second problem is digital inclusion. There's a lot of parts of the city, especially in communities of color and Black communities and low-income communities, that don't have the same level of access to internet at home that other parts of the city do. So, for instance, 30% of Black and Hispanic New Yorkers and 44% of New Yorkers living below the poverty line do not have broadband access at home. And overall in the city, about 29% of all households don't have broadband access at home. So that's a pretty significant number of people who don't have access. And you know, we're hoping that municipal broadband would be able to provide universal access to every New Yorker who lives in our city. And of course, that would include students and educators and workers. So that is one major reason why Moore is on board, is because over the past year with the COVID-19 crisis having exacerbated many of these divides that exist in our city, and with online school becoming such a large issue, you know, a lot of students don't have access to internet at home. And ideally, we would see a municipal broadband network be able to provide access to all of those students and teachers.
Right. And just as with so many things, the COVID crisis really exposed these racial and economic disparities that you alluded to just now. But of course, they predate the COVID crisis, and they will certainly postdate the COVID crisis, especially now as people are talking about moving toward more hybrid models of work and school and life. It's important to remember that there are people who are being really drastically left behind by their lack of access to reliable, not just internet, but also reliable, fast, affordable, right? All of these things that go with it. Yeah. So here's sort of a curveball question for you. You know, given that we are also talking on this edition of Revolutions Per Minute about the public power campaign, which faces, as you might expect, enormous opposition from the oil and gas industry, who don't want to see democratic worker control of power, right? What is this municipal broadband campaign up against in terms of corporate interests, and how do you plan to build power to get it done?
Well, you know, I think if you look at the state of broadband in the city and sort of existing municipal broadband initiatives across the United States, there are sort of a couple places where you face a lot of opposition. So sort of nationally, there's a lot of states that actually have moratoriums or bans on municipalities offering their own broadband access. Now, this isn't the case in New York. We actually don't have that barrier, but there does not mean that there are not political interests or forces who would rather us not have municipal broadband. And, you know, probably the most common or the most obvious opponent would be existing broadband providers like Charter Spectrum, which, you know, has had a history of tangling with New York State and New York City regulators and not necessarily providing the service that we would like to see.
Mm-hmm. So how does your campaign plan to build the power that's going to be required to take on these powerful corporate interests?
Of course, coalition building is a large component of our strategy. We've got a lot of organizations who are interested in this idea from different angles. So obviously Moore is interested in providing internet access for students and teachers. We've got coalition partners who are thinking about this from the unionized labor and organized labor angle, but also coalition partners who feel strongly about municipal broadband due to privacy concerns or network neutrality concerns or racial and economic equity concerns, all of which are very valid. So we've got this very broad segment of organizations who are working together on this. I think We haven't officially launched yet, but once we do officially launch, we will want to get a lot of volunteers making phone calls, you know, knocking on doors and telling people about municipal broadband and getting people on board for this idea so that it can gradually build momentum and eventually get implemented by the city.
Yeah, and from the perspective of an organizer, it seems to me like it's going to be a pretty interesting and maybe easy wrap, as we say, at the door, right? And I think a lot of this is also a matter of organizing the imagination, right? That there is an alternative to privately, you know, private sector controlled internet, right? Just as there is an alternative to privately owned oil and gas companies that aren't accountable to the communities that they continue to pollute, again, with the same racial disparity issues that you mentioned for tech. So there's a lot of parallels here, but I'm just picturing knocking on a door and saying, hey, do you hate Spectrum?
Right. And that's not a hard sell for somebody if you've only had Spectrum and have been experiencing internet outages, you know, can't get online for school, you know, et cetera.
Yeah, absolutely. So we know a better world is possible. And here at Revolutions Per Minute, we always like to offer our listeners a way to get involved with making that happen. So Kevin, what do you have to share with folks who might be interested in following this campaign or volunteering their labor or their expertise?
Yeah, so we have a very simple sign-up form. We would love to have folks just sign up to get involved or even just to get updates about the campaign. You can go to internetforall.nyc/join, and that's the word F-O-R spelled out. So internetforall.nyc/join.
Great. And any final thoughts for the audience?
I think this campaign, you know, I think is really going to take off, especially with the COVID-19 crisis and all of the fault lines that we're seeing with our existing internet infrastructure. You know, I think municipal broadband is an idea that is finally going to have its moment in 2021, 2022 or so, and really crossing our fingers that this is going to happen soon.
Great. Well, thanks so much for speaking with us here on Revolutions Per Minute. We wish you the best with the campaign, and please keep in touch. Let us know how it's going.
Thanks a ton, Amy. Have a good night.
Earlier in the show, you heard from Emily Gallagher, who is very excited to bring public power to Assembly District 50 in North Brooklyn. Earlier today, I talked to Daniel Golden, who with the New York City DSA Eco-Socialist, about the public power bills and how passing those bills is one of New York City DSA's next big fights.
Hey, Daniel, welcome back to RPM.
Hi, thanks for having me.
A few episodes ago, we had on some eco-socialist members and members of the New York Public Power Coalition to talk about how that coalition is building a movement to win public power. But we didn't really dig in at all to any of the bills, you know, what's actually going to be the way that we get public power in New York. So I was wondering if you could start off by talking about the two public power bills and what they'll do.
Yeah, sure. So first off, just a little bit of education on our energy grid. Our energy grid is basically split into three parts. You have generation, which is like the things that actually, you know, make the electricity we use, like the fossil fuel plants, solar panels, wind turbines, whatever. Then you have transmission, which basically takes those things to power centers, to regional areas, to cities and whatnot. And then you have the distribution side. And those are the companies that basically take that energy and distribute it to like your homes and churches and businesses, whatever. So, our two bills basically target the entirety of the energy system in two big chunks. Our first bill is called the New York Build Public Renewables Act, and it's getting introduced in the Assembly this week, which we're really excited for. And that bill would basically allow us to build out public renewable energy really, really quickly, in time to meet both our climate goals and also what the science demands. So right now, New York State actually already has a public utility. It's called the New York Power Authority, or NYPA. It was created by Franklin Delano Roosevelt when he was governor of New York. And it actually provides electricity to most municipal buildings, NYCHA, the subway system. And right now, NYPA is not allowed to build any renewable energy. They're not allowed to build any new energy, any energy generation. Our bill would allow NYPA to build out new renewable energy generation, and they can actually do that for quicker and cheaper than the private sector. So this will allow us, it also contains fairly stringent targets. So NYPA will have to build out like a lot of renewable energy really, really quickly. New York has a climate deadline of getting 70% of our renewable energy from of our electricity from renewable sources by 2030. We're not going to meet that at the rate we're going. And New York State has a really bad habit of setting stringent renewable energy deadlines and then missing it. Our bill will allow us to meet that really ambitious goal. So that's the New York Build Public Renewables Act, and it's kind of the first step towards winning public power. Our second bill is called the New York Utility Democracy Act, and that bill will basically take over every single private for-profit utility in the state. So that's companies like Con Edison, that's companies like National Grid, PSEG, Hudson Gas and Electric, and it will replace those companies with democratically run public utilities. So that means that instead of paying your bills to Con Edison, a private company that's going to, you know, take a big chunk of that and just give it to its investors, all of that money can go right back into the system, and you will be able to elect the people who run your energy utility. And this is really important because our energy utilities have been failing us. Mass blackouts are becoming like a yearly occurrence in New York City, which is happening because of the climate crisis. And it hasn't happened before. So it's really important that we are able to democratically, influence and give input to these energy utilities because of all of the changes that have been happening and because our system really is failing. So that's the second bill. It's a lot more ambitious, and it's kind of the step two. We want to use the Build Public Renewables Act to kind of prove that public utilities are a viable model, and then the Energy Democracy Act will be the next step into fully taking over our energy system. And after those two acts are passed, a major chunk of New York State's economy is going to be in public democratic hands, which is something that's, I think, pretty cool.
These are definitely some bills that the DSA slate up in Albany is very excited about. There was a big launch call earlier this week. Senator Jabari Brisport and then Assembly members Zoran Mondami and Ferris Efron-Forrest. And they were talking about, obviously the budget has been taking up all of the oxygen right now in New York. There's been a massive campaign led by DSA and others to tax the rich. But soon there'll be a lot of focus now on these public power bills. So can you talk about the significance of that, having so many DSA members across the city now going out and fighting for these bills?
Yeah, sure. It's really rad, first of all. Like, it's so cool. I started doing this in 2019 when, our only elected was Julia Salazar. And now we have five incredible elected officials who really deeply care about public power and just get it. It was wonderful having them on the launch call. I think that first of all, DSA's involvement in the budget process this year was really impressive. Our Tax the Rich campaign was huge, and we successfully contested the budget, which is huge. We have never been able to do that before. We didn't win everything. We didn't come close to winning everything, but we were still able to really flex our political muscles and, get a historic tax increase on the rich, as well as a lot of other good stuff in the budget. It's still not nearly enough, but it's a start and it's a sign of our growing power. But we really do, as an organization, we really need to follow it up with more actions, with more legislative successes. We've been building a lot of power, and we can't just win elections and then do absolutely nothing. Right. Like, that's a complete betrayal of what we're about. And with the budget, we were really successful, but we need to keep putting that pressure on, and we need to keep scoring legislative victories. And this year, public power is we have a really good chance of passing the Build Public Renewables Act. We have all hands on deck for passing the Build Public Renewables Act. Our electeds are 100% committed to doing that. And this is a great chance to get a absolutely major victory. And on top of that, there's a lot of talk about public power in Washington as well, in on the national level. A lot of kind of squad members have been really looking into public power, especially in light of Biden's infrastructure package, which is not nearly large enough, in terms of combating climate change. So this fight actually has national implications, because if we're able to pass the Build Public Renewables Act, we can get funding from Washington and use it as a blueprint for future public fights. And so this not only will be huge for New York State, but it's a huge national fight for DSA as well. So that's why I think, you know, we have, you know, over 40 public power campaigns across the country. I'm involved in national work as well. So this would be a huge victory that will not only enable us to keep winning in New York State, but allow us to start winning all across the country as well. Because when you win, that's the best way to build your campaign. You get more people to you, you draw more people to you, you get to keep fighting. So yeah, this is huge for New York, for DSA's influence on the state, but it's also huge for New York, for DSA's influence nationally as well.
Yeah, and I think, you know, one thing that's kind of cool about these citywide campaigns is, you know, it does bring all this organizing together. And that's so important when we're looking at our energy system, because, you know, literally, like, our communities are connected by things like pipelines. And so there's going to be three rallies happening this weekend to kind of launch the public power campaign. Can you talk a little bit about those and the significance of, you know, where these rallies are happening as it relates to, you know, how our energy system is currently set up in New York City?
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, so right now we're going to be having three launch rallies across the city in Brooklyn, Queens, and the Bronx. We have never done three simultaneous rallies before, so as you can imagine, I am extremely nervous, but our RSVP numbers look pretty good, so we're really excited for it. And yeah, like you said, we picked these rallies strategically to think about you know, to really just highlight, you know, the areas in New York City that are being the most impacted by, you know, not just the climate crisis, but also the blackouts and Con Ed's and incompetence, as well as National Grid's incompetence as well. So we're going to have our Queens rally is going to be in Eastern Queens on Saturday at 1 p.m. at Rufus King Park. And we picked Eastern Queens because Jamaica Queens has really been influenced, has really been impacted by the blackouts. You know, Eastern Queens, Jamaica had the biggest hit out of all of Queens. Yeah, it's also, you know, it's important to stress here that when these massive blackouts happen, they affect Black and brown working class communities the most. You know, it's not neighborhoods like Park Slope or Manhattan that are being affected by these blackouts. So our Bronx rally is going to be at 3 p.m. at the Con Edison offices at 1775 Grand Concourse Avenue. Again, the Bronx also gets disproportionately hit with these blackouts. And it also is the borough of Carl Hastie, who runs the assembly. So we really want to highlight that if Assembly Speaker Carl Hastie cares about the Bronx the way he says he does, then it's really important that we pass public power so that the Bronx is not impacted by these devastating blackouts every summer. And then our Brooklyn launch rally is going to be Saturday at 1 p.m. and it's going to be at the Parkside Avenue entrance to Prospect Park at Ocean Avenue. So it's called like Parkside Plaza. It's a Parkside and Ocean Avenue entrance. We picked that area in Brooklyn because it's fairly close to where the mass outages happened in Brooklyn, which happened mostly in actually Senator Kevin Parker's district. He was the state senator who chairs the Energy Committee. And it is also not it's sort of close to where the North Brooklyn pipeline is being built, which is a frack gas pipeline being built through North Brooklyn National Grid is pushing. That's going to have like really detrimental health effects to everyone in that community. And again, that pipeline is not being built right under Park Slope, right? It's being built in Black and brown communities in North Brooklyn and Brownsville. So that's kind of the significance of those rallies. Yeah, they're going to be this Saturday. You can, you know, find out more information at ecosocialist.nyc. And yeah, we would love to have you there. We really need all hands on deck for this campaign. We only have until June 10th to win.
I'm Lee Zishi, and you've been listening to Revolutions Per Minute on listener-sponsored WBAI at 99.5 FM. You can find us on our website, revolutionsperminute.simplecast.com, or on Twitter at NYCRPM. We'll catch you next time, New York City.
When the pandemic hit, theater artists had to get creative to produce stories without a stage, and they did. Award-winning playwright James Anthony Tyler and acclaimed director Jameel Jude got together to create an audio play called All We Need Is Us. Join me, Marcia Pendleton, your host and my guest, as we explore theater you can hear and that engages the imagination on Thursday, April 8th at 9 p.m. on Backstage Stories.
This is Scott Somer from Met Council's Housing Notebook. Only WBAI would give tenants a weekly voice on the air for over 50 years. And in New York City, tenants need a voice. Help WBAI stay on the air and serve the community by calling 212-209-2950. That's 212-209-2950 and make a pledge. And better yet, become a WBAI buddy and do it in the name of Housing Notebook. Thanks.
What?
Yes, only 2 hours left to become a listener sponsor, a member.